Back home again in dear old Elmhurst, and it seems that I can see the gleaming front porch lights still burning bright through the seven wards of trees. The backyard skunks send all their fragrance through the streets I used to roam. When I dream about the moonlight on her salt creek, how I long for my great big Elmhurst home.
Golly!
And now, podcasting from a two-person hot tub high atop the Butterfield Park Water Tower, it's the E-Town Lowdown with your handsome hosts, Robbie and Rick.
Welcome to another episode of the E-Town Lowdown. Today we have a very special guest, the Honorable Lee Daniels, a former Speaker of the House of the State of Illinois, an all-around great Elmhurst resident. Welcome, Lee.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And we also have joining us today, as usual, my sidekick Robbie and our producer extraordinaire PK. Let's start with where you were raised, Lee. Now, I know you were born in Lansing, Michigan.
Right.
And tell the story of how you ended up in Elmhurst.
Well, my mom and dad both went to York High School. And my dad grew up here in Elmhurst, and my mom grew up in Villa Park. And they got married and moved to college in Michigan State, Lansing, Michigan. And why my dad and mom were there at college, I was born in Lansing, Michigan. But they always intended to come back to Elmhurst. And a little bit of a side story there, because my dad became the chief of the campus police force at Michigan State. And the war broke out, and he went to the draft board. At that time, there was three of us in the family, my sister and my brother John and myself. And he said, if I join the FBI, they want me to move to Detroit. Will you draft me? No, that'd be fine. Go ahead. He moves to Detroit, and about a month later, they draft him.
Of course.
So he goes into the draft board. He says, I asked you that question because I've got three kids. And they said, that was the Lansing draft board. You didn't ask us here in Detroit. So he went to the service, and my mom moved us back to Elmhurst.
How old were you then when you moved back?
About 6 months.
Oh, wow.
Little guy.
So you remember a lot about Michigan then.
Yeah. I know they have a good basketball team.
Yes, they do.
Yeah, and then moved back to Elmhurst, and my grandfather was then the state's attorney of DuPage County, and he lived on Elm Street, 366 Elm, and behind that house was a caretaker's quarter, which is where we lived during the war. During leave, my dad came home, and of course, my mother had another baby, my brother Bill. So there was three boys and my sister in this little house.
Probably about 9 months after that visit home.
Something like that.
Yeah, okay.
But I'm one of eight kids, seven boys and one girl.
Wow.
So, little side story, my mom was nominated for Catholic Mother of the Year.
Yeah.
And she had to tell them she wasn't Catholic. And they said, well, how can that be? I have a very active husband.
So were you number three?
I was number three.
Okay. Okay. So your parents came here in what year?
Well, you mean when they...
When you were 6 months old, what year was that? We're going to figure out exactly how old you are.
Well, I could tell you if you ask me, but it was 42, 1942.
Okay.
You wear it well.
And was your father was an attorney, correct?
Yes. After the war, he went to work for Continental Casualty Insurance Company and went to law school at night and became a lawyer in 1950 and practiced law in Chicago and Elmhurst. And he was with, for a while, he was with a firm that employed a guy. You may not have heard of him, but his name is Bill Bauer.
Sure.
Yeah.
Approach the bench.
Yeah. one of the most outstanding citizens that Elmhurst has ever had.
Absolutely.
Yes. Bill's first job was working for my grandfather when he was state's attorney and worked for my dad at night.
Wow.
So it's a great history that we have with Bill. Judge Bauer.
Did your father specialize in a certain type of law?
Just general practice.
And he was Albert. right?
Yeah, Albert Daniels.
Is that your middle name?
Yes, yeah, that's right.
Yes, I noticed the A.
He didn't like the Albert name. They called him Bert, but he never liked. So he said, I'd never name my kid Albert.
Right.
But, of course, they named me my middle name.
Bert Daniels.
So tell us a little bit about your mother.
Well, my mom grew up in Villa Park. We've seen pictures of her. She was extremely good looking. And so I credit my dad for having good taste. But always,
and for your looks.
But she was my dad.
Sorry, Lee.
My dad was 6 foot, you know, he ranged between 6'3 and 6'4. My mom was like 5'4. And none of us kids had that kind of a height, you know, to us. And my dad would always blame my mom for the fact that we aren't really giants or anything like that. So I don't know. But she's probably, you know, everybody or most people, you know, say great things about their moms as they should. But my mom is really a trooper in many ways. Raised 7 boys and 1 girl. She just turned 100.
Wow.
She now lives in Bridgman, Michigan in a house.
Oh, wow, Bridgman, sure.
One of my brothers off and on stays with her on occasion. But at her 100th birthday, she announced she's working on her 104th birthday.
Very nice. I feel for your sister, too. 7 brothers.
Well, don't feel for her. She was the oldest, and she was kind of mean at times. And if she listened to this, she would probably swat me again. But, you know, we used to be pretty rough on her at times, but she could handle herself.
Yeah. Any places that you really liked vacationing as a child?
Well, a lot of times we went to Wisconsin, Manitowoc, Wisconsin, and Ely, Minnesota. My dad was a great fisherman. I remember many times. My dad never wanted to fish the lake where he had the cabin. He always had to portage someplace. So several times we'd have to portage over 3 lakes, carry a canoe, carry an engine, the gas, and the supplies, spend a whole day on the lake, catch a whole bunch of fish. And
he had to come up with something to keep you boys busy.
Well, he did, that's for sure.
Why didn't he want to fish on the lake he lived on?
It just was his thing. He liked to portage into hard-to-get-to lakes. So in Ely, Minnesota, I remember well, you know, going into lakes, 3 lakes away. And, you know, sometimes the portage was a mile long. So carrying a canoe and your engine and everything was a lot of work. But
Bob, if you had 7 sons, wouldn't you find things for them to do?
I'd have to.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, maybe he was trying to get out of sight of your mom.
I don't think so. No. But I perhaps, who knows?
So growing up in Elmhurst, what schools did you attend?
I went to Roosevelt Grade School, which is, of course, Margie Davis Park now.
Right.
And then my dad had, when he got back from the war, my grandfather had bought him a piece of property on Walnut Street. And my dad built a house on Walnut Street. So we lived there until I was in 6th grade. And then he sold that and moved to Cottage Hill into the what was then known as the Lee Sturgis House. The Sturgis family were one of the founding families of Elmhurst. And so we moved into that house. We were the second owners of that house. And I lived there. And let's see, I actually was in law school, my second year of law school, when they sold that house.
So do you have any stories about that house or anything you did in that house that you'd like to share?
Oh, tons of stories. Some I won't, but,
okay.
You know, we thought for sure that Lee Sturgis had buried money somewhere in the walls of the house. And when we moved in the house, it had been in somewhat disrepair because he was elder and didn't really care for it to keep up the maintenance. So we'd have to come home from school every day, and we would strip wallpaper, paint walls, and fix up the house. And, of course, as Paul said earlier, what do you do when you have 7 kids? You know, you put them to work. Yeah. And we actually did a lot of work in the house every day. But there was a cork floor ballroom in the house on the 3rd floor. And so we always kind of enjoyed going up there and pretending like we were having a ball or something like that. It had 21 rooms, so it was really a sizable house and a great house for a big family.
Is that house still stands, right?
Yes, I think the Kleins own it now.
Oh, yeah, sure. Okay, yeah. We were just talking to him recently.
Did you ever party on the 3rd floor, Lee?
Oh, many times.
Okay.
Some parties we told my parents about and some we didn't.
You could have a party upstairs in that house and your parents could be downstairs and they might not know it.
They might not know it.
It's a big house.
But as we grew older, the boys always wanted the room in the back of the 2nd floor, which was the maid's quarters, because it was private and had its own stairwell.
Yeah, right.
So
yeah.
It was kind of that was the fun thing for us
Sneaky.
To do.
Sneaky. What other schools did you attend after Roosevelt?
In sixth grade, I went to Hawthorne. And then at that point, seventh and eighth grade were junior high schools. And it was Elmhurst Junior High, which is now Sandburg. I went there for 2 years and then York High School and graduated from York in 1960 and then went to the University of Iowa. Finished my
Iowa.
Iowa, the Hawkeyes.
Go Hawkeyes.
Great team. Graduated from there and went to John Marshall Law School and graduated from there.
So when you were in high school, were you involved in any activities, clubs, sports?
Yes. I was a gymnast 4 years in high school, played football my last year. Wasn't very good, but stuck it out. And I was in choir. And at that point, I was a boy soprano. I did a lot of vocal singing.
Do you still sing?
Not anymore. In the shower sometimes.
Huh. What'd you do as a gymnast?
I was trampoline and tumbling. Fell on my head a lot. So and then went to Iowa. I was on the team for a year and a half, and then quit that. It was
gymnastics at Iowa too.
Mm-hmm.
Wow!
But again, I wasn't very good. Now that's in comparison. My brother John, my older brother, was an All-American gymnast at Michigan State.
Wow!
And in those days, you could specialize, and he was a free exercise specialist. He was one of the best in the world. Missed winning the national championships by a half point 2 years in a row.
Is that the floor routine then?
Yeah. But okay. At those days, it was on the basketball court, no padding.
Jeez.
So when you made a mistake and you fell, you really hurt.
Wow.
Now you have the padding, whereas you can see them when they bounce.
Yeah, right.
You know, and they've got that spring, so you can throw a double back, a full twisting double back, or some other routine, which you couldn't do on the basketball court.
Triple Lindy?
Something like that.
Did you have any jobs in high school?
I did. I worked at Egan Standard Station.
Oh, Jack Egan?
Yeah. I worked for Jack
Egan. I knew
Egan.
Jack really well growing up.
Wait, was really? That on York Road at the time?
It was on where Lakeside Bank is right now.
Right.
He also had a station up on Lake Street, too. Jack did at one point.
Then I worked at Mount Emlem Cemetery for a summer, which was interesting.
Digging?
No, I cut grass. You had to be a union member to dig, but we cut grass.
How would your classmates in high school describe you?
Small. you know,
can you
fun.
Qualify
I like to think they think I was fun. I was
ironically, though, you became a big man.
Yeah, well, I grew in many directions.
Well, I don't mean big that way. I mean big like
tall.
Importantly.
He's tall.
Yeah. I mean, big important.
Big important, right. But, you know, kind of shy, a little bit shy. It's so many people are in high school. You know, I don't think I was, I think I was outgoing, but not real outgoing.
So you blossomed in college?
No, I was really withdrawn in college. I was focused on getting through college. I finished in 3 years. And
What inspired you to go to Iowa?
In 1963.
No, what inspired you?
To go to Iowa?
Mm-hmm.
The gymnastics team.
Oh, wow.
They recruited several of us from York High School.
Wow.
It was a new team. And God forbid I'd go to Michigan State where my brother was an All-American gymnast.
Yeah, right.
Because I truly tell you, I wasn't that good where John was outstanding. And I didn't, the comparison would have been pretty harsh.
So if you could write something about yourself in your high school yearbook, and maybe you did back then, I don't know. I know our yearbooks, we couldn't do that. What would you write about yourself back in high school?
Probably that somewhat withdrawn, somewhat shy, wished he was taller because I was short in high school. And
but I don't know any tall, successful gymnasts, so it worked, worked in your favor.
It's more in my brother's favor, yeah.
So when did you start to formulate the idea of becoming an attorney? Was it in college?
Pretty early on. My grandfather, as I said earlier, was state's attorney of DuPage County. He served in that position for 12 years.
Gotcha.
And then he ran for the Illinois House and was elected to the House for 3 terms. I was named after him. So there were times he would take me to events as his namesake. So
kind of
got me interested in politics and law. And I always enjoyed law. And early on kind of made a decision I'd be a lawyer. Because if you, as so many of us in our lifetime, go through things like you tick off. Am I going to be a doctor? No way could I be a doctor. Am I going to be a scientist? No. So ultimately get to a point where you say, well, I guess I'll be a lawyer, you know. But the law is a great profession because there's so many things you can do with it. Yeah. And that's why I liked it so much and like it.
Well, let's take a quick break and we'll be right back on the Lowdown.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are Steve Waddington and the Retro Rocket All-Stars. And when we're not rocking in Southern California, we listen to the E-Town Lowdown. With your love to Robbie and Rick. E-Town Lowdown, you know what I'm talking about.
This is Mary Beth Harper, director of the Elmhurst Public Library, and you're listening to the E-Town Lowdown with your hosts Robbie and Rick, but PK is the one with all the talent.
We're back on the Lowdown with special guest Lee Daniels.
Lee, what types of law did you practice or specialize in?
Early in my career, before I went to the General Assembly, I did a lot of trial work. A lot of divorce work, some minor criminal work, but I liked the courtroom a lot. And I would spend most of my days started in Wheaton at the courthouse. Later on, and I was then appointed as the Special Assistant Attorney General by then Attorney General William Scott to represent the state to liquidate a company called Equity Funding Life Insurance, which had a multi-million dollar fraud scheme that they started out of California, and it came back to Illinois because Equity Funding had listed their headquarters as Elmhurst, Illinois. So I did. That was a three-year project that I spent lots of times in California and 6 months on trial in Wheaton. Ended up in the U.S. Supreme Court refusing certiorari to approve the liquidation of the company. Shortly after that, I was sworn in as a member of the Illinois General Assembly. My practice then changed to real estate and healthcare. And at the end of my career, I was primarily doing healthcare work.
So when did you decide to get interested and involved in politics?
Probably early on. Probably was influenced by my grandfather, I'm
right,
sure.
Right.
Because we were walked precincts for him for his election. He'd give us a nickel. We'd go to door to door with all the campaign materials and run it around. So that was one of the things that we did.
But at what point did you take your first step into the arena?
1966, excuse me. I became a member of the York Township Board of Auditors, which is a township office, was reelected to that post and then didn't run for reelection in 72. And then in 1974, I ran for and was elected to the Illinois House.
Oh, wow.
Have you ever lost an election?
Only for speaker.
Okay. But not a general election?
Not a general election, no.
That's got to be a nice
resume.
Yeah.
Well, it was nice. I mean, this is a great area, as you all know, because you live here. But the people are really super people to work with, to deal with. And, you know, walking the precincts, getting to know the area, you know, where I grew up. It really is. People are quite wonderful in this area, so it was really my privilege to spend the 32 years in Springfield representing this district.
Yeah, but wonderful people support wonderful people.
Well, thank you.
Yes.
When you first ran, did you have an opponent in the primary?
I did. Actually, there were three of us running for two spots. At that time, there was what we called multi-member districts. So instead of one House member per district, there were three. And so traditionally, and when I ran for office, Pate Phillip had been a legislator in the House, ran for the Senate. So I actually ran for the seat that he held. My running mate at that time was Gene Hoffman. When I first ran in 1974, Carl Roth, who was the mayor of Villa Park, filed for election. So it was Gene Hoffman, myself, and Carl running for two spots, three of us running for two. And that was in 1974, and I won that one and went on to win the general election.
Was that with Gene?
Yes. Or did,
yeah, okay.
Yes.
Yeah.
So the three from this district were Bill Redman, who then became the Speaker of the House from Bensonville, Gene and myself. And then 1981, the cutback amendment, which was sponsored by then Pat Quinn, reduced it to one member per district, which is what it is today.
Were there other opponents in that first election in the general election other than Redman and you?
No,
and
it was
Gene?
Just the three of us.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So your real battle was in the primary then?
At that point it was, right.
Was Gene the other guy that won?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. He was another fine gentleman.
Yes. Yeah. Gene was my top floor leader in Springfield when I became the Republican leader. So we are very close.
Yeah, I remember him.
Who was the toughest opponent you ever ran against in a general election or a primary?
The toughest opponent I ever ran against was Mike Madigan for Speaker of the House. In the primary.
Really?
Yeah.
Was he that tough?
And we'll talk a lot about him later, hopefully.
He's just a little guy.
Yeah, he's shorter than I am, believe it or not. I would say my first election was the toughest.
How did you get along with the folks on the other side of the aisle when you were first elected?
Well, when I in 1975, I was sworn in as member of the House. And that point, you may remember, was the Watergate year. And that was a tough year for Republicans. So I was one of the few new Republicans to be elected to office, nationwide for that matter. Henry Hyde was our congressman at the time and was elected to Congress in the same year from this area. At the time, we were looking at the election process, and I had become a member of the House. The Democrats had taken massive control of the Illinois House with 107 members out of 177. So the Republicans were at a mass minority. Bill Redman emerged as a candidate for Speaker of the House in 1975. There were 96 ballots taken in the House before Bill Redman was finally elected. Now, when I say that 96 ballots, that sounds like a lot. It was, but it's even worse than it sounds, because these were oral verified roll call votes. Wow. They would call your name, you would stand up, and you'd vote for the person. And many times, some of these people would give big speeches.
Yeah.
I'm for John Jones because he's the greatest guy from Southern Illinois you'd ever see. And they'd go on and on and on.
Wow.
And there were, remember, there were 177 members of the Illinois House at that time. So the roll calls would take 8 hours.
Wow.
There were 96 of them. And what happened was the Democrats just couldn't decide on who their speaker was. They had like eight candidates running, and they couldn't get the majority of votes at that
time. So did everybody have to say something so they could get on TV?
Something like
that.
What
was the name of the guy from ABC7? Hugh somebody or another that used to cover Springfield? Remember who I mean?
See, Peter Nolan was 9. Hugh Hill was Channel
5. Hugh Hill.
He was Channel 5.
Okay.
Yeah. Great guy. Great guy. One of the old-time reporters, and you could really trust him. And that's the important thing, I think, that we're missing today. When somebody would give you a word then, they'd keep the word.
Yeah.
And if they'd say, this is off the record, they meant it was off the record. Today, you can't say anything to anybody and trust that it's going to stay private.
Right.
And to make any kind of government to be effective, you have to be able to count on some issues of privacy. Because lawmaking isn't pretty. You know, people have likened it to making sausage, and it's similar to that. So,
was there an individual or a group of individuals that showed you the ropes when you were first elected to the House?
Yes, there were. A guy by the name of Charlie Fleck, who became a judge, and I think he's retired now. He's in a law firm called Schiller, DuCanto, and Fleck, which is a pretty prominent divorce family law firm. I relied on him somewhat. Gene Hoffman, very much so. Pate Phillip, you know, were mentors and would make sure that I didn't do stupid things, which you're always prone to do.
And how much time did you spend in Springfield when you were a freshman House member?
Well, 6 months was the session. Generally, it'd start in January, end of July at that time. So you were there at the start maybe 2 days a week, 3 days a week, 4 days a week, 5 days a week, and at the end it was full round 7 days a week.
And at that time, you're trying to keep your law practice going, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the pay at that time was $7,500 for 2 years.
Wow.
So
you were in it for the money.
Yeah, right.
Where did you stay when you were down there?
When I first went down there, I stayed in a hotel. And over the years, I stayed in various places. I'd rent an apartment. And then when I became the Republican leader, I was there quite a bit. Most of my time was spent in Springfield. I rented an apartment and then actually bought a condo at one point.
Let's take another quick break here on the Lowdown, and we'll be right back.
What is the deal with Robbie and Rick? Are they geniuses? Are they before their time? I don't know. It's a show about nothing. I think you should listen to them on the E-Town Lowdown.
Wow. Guests of the Lowdown will receive an Elmhurst E-Town Lowdown coffee mug suitable for all types of beverages, courtesy of the Elmhurst Armpit Orchestra.
And now, here's Rick with another edition of Standing on My Heavily Reinforced Soapbox.
Lately, I've been hearing a whole lot about this Instant Pot craze. People say it gets the job done a lot quicker than the regular pot. They use all these code words to throw us off. They use terms like baked and fried. So those of us that overhear them think they're talking about making dinner or something. But I'm on to them. They can't fool old Rick. I'm guessing you listeners are onto them as well. Now, I have never taken any illegal drugs, and I don't know anything about them. I'm not familiar with that whole culture. But friends, they are talking about cannabis, marijuana, weed, ganja, grass,
Rick,
tea,
Rick,
420. Robbie, I'm not finished. You got to let me finish. So I'm in line at the supermarket last week, and there are two ladies in front of me, and I hear them talking about how great this Instant Pot is. One lady is actually telling the other lady about how much faster the Instant Pot works and how it helps her relax. She's going on and on about it. She tells the other lady how hungry she gets with this Instant Pot. These ladies are exchanging suggestions about what to add. Onion, herb, you get the picture. In the grocery store. Do people have no shame? For the love of Bob Marley, this stuff is illegal. They are in line at the Elmhurst Mariano's, not the Denver Doobie Dispensary. Come on.
Yo, Rick, wait. Hang on.
Robbie, I'm not finished yet. Just let me finish. But that's not the real story. These ladies at the grocery store aren't the only ones I've heard talking about this Instant Pot. Lowdown listeners, I want you to listen very carefully. This past weekend, I couldn't believe my ears. Who of all people is absolutely obsessed with this Instant Pot? You'll never guess. None other than our own Mayor Morley. Or, as I now refer to him, Spliffy Steve. He can't stop recommending this Instant Pot to everybody he encounters. He gets this little glimmer in his eyes, and, well, actually, I think it's more of a glassy-eyed look when he talks about his beloved pot. When will this end? Even our elected officials are addicted.
Robbie, just let me finish. I'm almost finished, Robbie.
People of Elmhurst, we must put a stop to this now. You need to write your Elmhurst elected officials and demand they put an end to this nefarious practice immediately. No matter who you decide to write, copy Alderman Kevin York. I've never met a pot smoker who wears tight bicycle shorts. Drop what you are doing. Write that letter now. As always, I stand tall on my heavily reinforced soapbox to protect the good people of Elmhurst from the evil that lurks within. Good day.
Are you finished, Rick?
Yes.
The Instant Pots everyone is talking about are crock pots. Crock pots have traditionally been slow cookers, but the new Instant Pots cook the food much quicker. They use heat and pressure to cook the food evenly, but in much less time than a traditional crock pot. Mayor Morley uses his Instant Pot several times each week to prepare delicious and nutritious meals for his family.
So he's not getting high in the hot tub with Alderman Kennedy?
No.
It's just a crock pot?
Yes.
Oh, well, never mind then. And we're back in the two-person hot tub high above Butterfield Park with our special guest, Lee Daniels.
Lee, you mentioned Pate Phillip briefly before, and it sounds like when you got started down in Springfield, you worked kind of hand-in-hand with him. Is that the case?
That is true.
Can you tell us a little bit about him? He seems like an interesting guy to have worked with.
Very interesting and very, very true. Pate was a very important part of my career. There's no question about that. He supported me for the Township Board of Auditors, for the Illinois House, and for Speaker, and was very helpful as I went through my career. He's a strong man, as you know. He is opinionated. Sometimes he makes you cringe a little bit, but he's very straightforward, and there's no mistaking where Pate Phillip would stand on an issue. He became very successful in government, served as president of the Senate for 10 years, and was a very, very important man to this state and, I would say, to this area.
Once a Marine, always a Marine.
Well, that's true, and he reminded us of that, too.
And did he have a formal role in the Republican Party in Illinois?
Pate?
Yes.
He was the chairman of the DuPage County Republican Organization. which was the strongest Republican organization in the state and one of the strongest in the country. So when somebody would run for president or a national office, a state office, a local office, they wanted to make sure they had Pate Phillips support.
And when you went into the House, then it was about the same time that he went into the Senate, right?
That's the reason, because he ran for the Senate, left his House seat. I ran for his House seat.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
True.
I have a saying, and that is that no good emperor grooms a successor. And I always thought Pate was a bit of an emperor, and he didn't really want, you know, I mean, you were obviously one of those people that were very influential in the Republican Party, and there were a few others, and I think he kind of left you guys to fight it out a little bit, don't you think?
Well, we did have our chances to have our differences, and there's some truth to that. I mean, Pate was a master person, and I was like a little brother to him, and if I stepped out of the role that he wanted me in, he let me know it. And so we had our differences at times, but, you know, overall, I have to acknowledge and should acknowledge that he was very important in my career.
And I assume you worked a lot with the Senate in general.
You did, but there's a natural inclination for senators and House members to have a difference of opinion. And the Senate has half the members of the House. I always call them, the people of the House of the Lords. They're older, not as wise, and fatter than those of us in the House. Of course, they would say the reverse. So
right.
there was a natural difference between the House and the Senate.
Who was your favorite governor that you ever worked with?
George Ryan.
Well, that was a quick answer. Yeah, right. You didn't even think about
well,
that.
Well, yeah. I mean, I will tell you, I had a great deal of respect for Jim Thompson, one of the smartest men I ever met. Very, very skilled governor. But I was kind of new to the role as the Republican leader, and I was learning as we went through it. And I had my differences with Thompson. He would sponsor major tax increases. I'd fight him on it. And one time we went right to the mat. He wanted a permanent tax increase. I said, the best I'll give you is a temporary tax increase. You know, he wasn't happy about that, but ultimately we won that issue. So I have a great respect for him. A terrific governor, longest serving governor in the history of the state, followed by Jim Edgar, who came in at a tough time, financially a tough time. Jim Edgar would handle your state budget like it was his own money. In other words, he was very careful on how he would spend it. Right guy, right man, right time, but didn't have an economy that you could do a lot of things. George Ryan became the governor. He and I were close. He was speaker, and I was his Republican majority whip and served in his leadership team. He was the kind of governor, he knew how to handle government, knew how to work the legislature, had been the speaker, and he knew all the players and knew how to get them together. And I did a lot of the floor work for Governor Ryan and did a lot of representing him in various activities.
Did you kind of feel bad for him when he had his downfall?
It was worse than bad. I felt terrible. I think, you know, none of what he was convicted of was the result of him being governor. It all took place when he was Secretary of State. I had a lot of trouble dealing with that because I had such a great fondness for him and still do today and thought he was a great governor.
How about Mike Madigan? Let's jump back to him for a second. What was that transition like when you turned over the speaker position to him?
When I lost that speakership and gave it back to him?
Yes.
It was hard.
Yeah.
You know, but it was hard on him when he lost it to me.
Yeah, oh yeah.
And when that happened, he told me it was the worst 2 years of his life. I said, those were the most wonderful 2 years of my life.
Yeah, right, right.
So,
what was your relationship with Madigan before you became speaker?
Before I became speaker, I was the minority leader of the House, or the Republican leader for...
But I mean, how'd you get along with him? That's what I mean by relationship.
We fought like cats and dogs, ended up having a mutual respect for each other because we stood strong for what we believed in, and we represented our areas and represented the state and did it well. And at the end of the day, you know, there were times, truly, that if we had had a gun, we might have shot each other on the House floor. Some of these arguments and debates you get into, they're very passionate and very strong because of the beliefs you have, because you're representing an area that sends you down there to do good work for them. And when something goes different than you want, I mean, it can be very emotional and very tough and very dramatic. So Mike and I had tremendous battles at times, and I can truly say that I always respected him because, first of all, without a doubt, he's probably the most skilled politician that you've seen in Illinois in your lifetime.
Is that a compliment?
Sure.
I mean, there's two sides to that.
Yeah, well, sure. Yeah. A compliment as far as government's concerned.
Yeah, right.
Now, the unfortunate part today is there's so much negativity in government today that it makes it very hard to govern. And after all, what we want people to do is to move the state forward, not to keep it stagnant, not to reverse progress. We want to advance progress. And whether people like it or not, there are things we need to do in this state. There's things like infrastructure. There's things like roads, bridges, schools, you know, public facilities and programs that you need to have. Now, we could cut all those back, but people don't want that today. They want to move forward. They want programs that deal with issues that are of concern to them. So what do you have today? You have gridlock, not only in Springfield or every state capital in this country, but Washington as well. So when people ask me about Mike Madigan, they expect me to say, oh, he's a bum. He's not a bum. He's a devoted father, devoted husband, and a very hard worker. He's the most focused person that you'd want to see. Does that mean I'd vote for him? No. I won't.
And we have some other aspects of Madigan that we want to explore later, but let me step back a minute and just ask you about a few other folks that you've worked with and you know. Henry Hyde, what was your relationship like with him?
Very close. We shared office space in Addison, and I saw him frequently. Probably one of the brightest men you'd ever want to meet. Formerly a trial lawyer and a very well-known trial lawyer. So he was good in court as he was on the House floor in Washington. He was a real thinker, a doer, and somebody that could bring people together. And as you know, he had strong beliefs on pro-life and was a pro-life representative down there and passed what they called the Hyde Amendment, so you couldn't use federal funds for abortions, which carried through the country. So his thoughts and beliefs were strong. I always enjoyed him because he was so brilliant and so skilled in the legislative arena. As you know, he served as chairman of the Judiciary Committee in Washington, which is very, very powerful. He was on the International Relations Committee. And when I first ran for office in 1974, one of the first visits I did other than to Pate and to Gene was to visit Henry Hyde, who spent 3 hours with me, and I roadmapped my campaign and listening to him and followed that through and, as you know, was victorious in the campaign.
Did he ever share any inside stories of the impeachment of Clinton?
Yes, he did.
Anything you can share with us?
Some of which I could tell you. He had made a deal with the Senate that if the House impeached Clinton, that the Senate would convict him and stand strong. In other words, he didn't want to, as you know, the process works. The House impeaches, the Senate is the trial judge on the case, and they would have to convict. So it's a two-step process.
But he was impeached but not convicted, right?
That's correct.
Yeah.
What happened?
Did they renege?
Yes, they did.
Wow. Wow, that's
and,
big.
And it was very, very tough because he didn't want to do it unless he had support in the other chamber. And they assured him that if you impeach him, we'll convict him. Well,
wow.
The rest is history.
Was there some other event that happened subsequent to the deal that
I think they just got nervous.
They changed their mind? Okay. You've met quite a few presidents. Name some presidents that you've gotten to know a little bit or spend some time with.
Well, I can't say that, you know, that I was friendly with any of them because, you know, that would be too deep of a relationship. But I knew most of them that I served with. But the one, if you were to ask me the question, who most impressed you, you wouldn't be surprised to have me say Ronald Reagan. Sure. I mean, just his presence alone. I mean, I was in the Oval Office a couple of times with him. And just sitting there, it was like an awesome time. I mean, this was the seat of power in the world, and here's the most powerful man in the world, and he carried every bit of strength and aura as a leader that you'd expect.
Yeah, a man in charge.
Were you tempted to steal an ashtray or something like that from the Oval Office?
I just wanted to shake his hand.
What brought you there to the Oval Office?
I was on a federal level, I was a member of the National Conference of State Legislators. Now, what that group is, it's a group of legislators that represents the states to the federal government. And this is every state in the country sends delegates to the national conference. And I became the president of that. So 7,500 members, and I represented the national conference to the federal government. and would go to Washington to advocate on behalf of the states.
I believe it was the 1994 election that led to you becoming Speaker of the House in 1995, correct? Or was it in
great 90- days.
So what led up to that? Did you see it coming?
Well, 92 was a great Republican year. Actually, Pate was elected Senate President in 92, and it laid the groundwork for the strong Republican year in 94, in which I was elected the Speaker of the House at that time. And it was quite a Republican event because we took all the constitutional officers and all the leadership in the state. So Pate was the President of the Senate. I was the Speaker of the House. Jim Ryan was Attorney General, and Jim Edgar was the governor. And so we had all of the office. George Ryan was Secretary of State. So it was a pretty good year.
Did you all see it coming?
Had a good idea, but I don't think that we saw the depth of what was going to happen. I mean, I won 13 seats in that year. We knew we had a good chance to win the majority, but not by that number.
So when I look back at those times, it seemed like everything worked. I mean, obviously there were issues, but and then you think about things now, and maybe it's just because it's in the present, but it seems like it's kind of chaotic. What was the difference? Was it that trust you were talking about, or what's going on? What's making things different?
I think several factors. I think that's one of the things. I mean, as I told you earlier, Mike Madigan and I would have shot each other at times. The feelings were so deep on what we believed in. But we always knew at the end of the day we had to come together. We had to pass a budget. We had to deal with school funding. We had to deal with funding for the most vulnerable population. We had to make sure that the budget was balanced. And we did those things because we knew at the end of the day we had to do them. Now, we didn't have social media. We didn't have cell phones with video cams. We didn't have media that was going to basically follow every step of the way. And if you made a mistake, you were all over the internet, all over the world.
Right.
And so some of the pressure was not on us that is on some of the members of the House and Senate and government today. And I think that's worked to a disadvantage of government per se. And I think we need to deal with that.
Yeah, this transparency has its limitations or restrictions.
Well said.
Yeah.
Was there anything in particular that you were most proud of accomplishing while you were Speaker?
I would say keeping a lid on taxes. We did the temporary tax, as I said, which I fought Thompson on. And that temporary tax, we made a promise to Illinois citizens that would repeal it 18 months down the road. We did. We kept our word. That was one of the big battles in the House and Senate, and we got that done. Stalking law, which is a result of a murder that took place here in Illinois in Elmhurst.
I remember it.
And you remember well was
I
a result of that.
It was, too.
John Milner was the chief and came to my office, and we passed the first anti-stalking law in the country. Yeah. I dealt with several criminal law issues, but probably most of all, I think if I highlighted anything, was dealing with our most vulnerable population in the area of developmental disabilities, creation of facilities for people that suffered from mental or physical challenges, and places for them to live and grow. So
anything that you would have done differently if you could go back? I mean, we all have regrets, but anything? Or
you're asking a guy who did a lot. So
in 32 years, I probably cast 20,000 or more votes.
Yeah.
So there might have been two or three that you would change.
That's fair enough. I got one or two things I could change. He's got 5,000.
Okay, let's take another quick break here on the Lowdown. We'll be right back.
Hello, Pete Kruger here from the Elmhurst Independent Newspaper. When I want a good laugh, I listen to E-Town Lowdown. Even though Rick, Robbie, and PK podcast from a hot tub, they're three cool dudes.
The E-Town Lowdown, brought to you by the wonderful folks at the Elmhurst Armpit Orchestra, featuring the biggest bass drum in the world at 9 feet in diameter. Yes, you heard that right. 9 feet in diameter.
And we're back on the Lowdown with my personal favorite segment, the E-Town Lowdown Mowdown, where we mow down our special guest to their very core. And today's special guest is our good friend Lee Daniels. Okay, you ready for this, Lee?
Ready.
The first question is paperback or hardcover?
Hardcover.
Walking or bicycle?
Bicycle.
Favorite drink?
Vodka.
Grants or Sioux Cups?
Sioux Cups.
Big city or country?
Country.
Restaurant or home cooking?
Restaurant.
Golf or tennis?
Golf.
Cubs or Sox?
Sox.
Ping pong or pool?
Pool.
East End or York Commons?
East End.
Mashed potatoes or baked potatoes?
Baked.
Fiction or nonfiction?
Oh, probably fiction.
Spock or Scotty?
Spock.
Bailey's or Stephen's Steakhouse?
Stephen's Steakhouse.
Okay, we're going back. Let's go A&P or National?
A&P.
French fries or onion rings?
French fries.
TCBY or 31 flavors?
TCBY.
Morning or evening?
Evening. I went to night law school.
The West Wing or House of Cards?
House of Cards.
Clinton or Obama?
Clinton.
E-book or conventional book?
Conventional.
Favorite color?
Blue.
L.A. Law or Boston Legal?
Boston Legal.
Wisconsin or Michigan?
Michigan all the way.
Hawkeyes or Blue Jays?
Oh, thanks a lot. Yeah. Since I'm senior advisor to the president of Elmhurst College. Oh, I love the Blue Jays.
Okay, there's your answer.
Cronkite or Rather?
Rather.
The beach or the mountains?
Boy, that's a good one. I think the mountains.
The Beatles or the Stones?
The Beatles.
James Brown or James Taylor?
James Taylor.
What was your first record album?
Johnny Mathis.
Really? Wow.
Chances are it's Johnny Mathis.
Yeah, chances are.
East Coast or West Coast?
West Coast.
Invisibility or super strength?
Oh, super strength.
You can go a lot of places when you're invisible.
Yeah, sure.
How about When Harry Met Sally or Dirty Harry?
Well, how could you not pick When Harry Met Sally with the scene in the restaurant?
I'll have what you're having, Robbie.
You asked the question.
Says a romantic.
What's your favorite Elmhurst pizza place?
Probably Roberto's.
Drive or fly?
Fly.
Favorite sport?
Well, it was running, but now that I'm older, I'd say bicycle and walking.
Dogs or cats?
Oh, dogs. Man's best friend.
Fallon or Kimmel?
Kimmel.
So you answered it one way. Favorite sport to watch?
Football.
Okay.
Yorktown restaurant or Corner Cottage?
Whoa, you're going back. I would say Corner Cottage.
Tom Cruise or Tom Hanks?
Tom Hanks.
Elevator or stairs?
Elevator.
We have one last question for you. Sure. That was submitted by one of our fans who's a former Elmhurst resident, now lives in California, Mark Mitchell, and that's Three Stooges or Three's Company?
Three Stooges.
Wow. Great answers. We'll be right back on the Lowdown.
This is Bob Robertson, Sr. When I have insomnia, I listen to Robbie and Rick on the E-Town Lowdown. Why don't you?
Hi, this is Pamela Dunley. As president and CEO of Elmhurst Hospital, I know that sometimes laughter can be the best medicine. When I need a good laugh, I tune into the E-Town Lowdown. And you should too. Give it a try.
And we're back on the E-Town Lowdown with our special guest, former Speaker of the House in the state of Illinois, Lee Daniels.
Can Mike Madigan ever be defeated as long as he has his health and his wits?
No.
Can you expand on that?
You want me to elaborate on that? Please.
Please.
Okay.
Jim, please elaborate on that.
Well, remember, the state legislators are elected first from a district. So I had the good fortune of never having anyone come close to
beating me or taking me out because I worked my district and kept close to them. So that's 100,000 people that vote for you, and you're sent to Springfield. And then in the case of Mike Madigan, he then runs for Speaker of the House, and he needs a majority of the members of the House to vote for him for that position, which he's held because the Democrats have held a majority since 1996. And he knows how to work with other members. Many of the members there are only in Springfield because he helped their campaigns. He's got a strong political organization. So the fact of the matter is, as long as he wants to stay there, he'll be in Springfield.
You know, the three of us watched the documentary that you were in quite a bit about Madigan. It came out a couple of years ago, and it was interesting to watch how he had an opponent in his district, and all of a sudden there's a couple other people that nobody's ever heard of, and it's a mostly Hispanic district, right. And so he had three Hispanics in himself, and there's just no way to defeat him, is there?
No, he's got a strong political organization, you know, and the jobs that he has at the CTA, at McCormick Place, in state government, are legendary, and that's something that Democrats are very good at. And they do that in the start. Patronage is something very important to them. It's not as important to Republicans, hasn't been historically. But when you call upon the people that are working in a job because of him and he wants them in election time, they're there. And in the old days, when I say the old days, previously when we had control, we had strong organizations in this area. Addison Township was one of the strongest. Pat Durante was the chairman.
He's a great guy.
And when you need workers, you'd call Pat and he'd send 20 workers over to work a precinct or work a district.
Right.
Do you believe Madigan takes any, just in his own mind, takes any responsibility for where Illinois is right now? And I mean, I personally believe that Illinois is kind of a laughingstock in terms of our financial prowess. Do you think he takes any responsibility in his own head for that? I mean, he's never going to publicly.
You know, it's hard to say. He's a power-structured person. Totally. And everything he does evolves around power, retaining power. And so you'd have to say that he has a responsibility for the problems we're in. He has a very strong position. But the fact of the matter is the strongest elected office in the state is the governor. And the governor has to show leadership, a budget approach, and how we get there. And in order to do that, you have to work with the people that are in the other branches of government, whether it's in the judicial branch or the legislative branch, because they're co-equals. So if you're going to go negotiate something, why would you call somebody a crook when you got to negotiate with them to get the job done? And that's some of the concerns I have about Illinois today. Do I want to vote for Mike Madigan? No, I'm a Republican. I believe in the Republican principles. Do I respect him? Yes, I do. Do I know that you have to deal with a person in power like that? Yes, you do. And that's what we're missing today, and I think is unfortunate that it's one of the problems we have.
Do you have any either funny or interesting stories about your relationship with him, not necessarily on the political stage, but your personal relationship?
Sure. Before I became the Republican leader, we actually friendly. In fact, we were at some National Conference of State Legislators together, and occasionally he and his wife and my wife and I would dine together. And we actually were friendly. But when you then are elevated to a position of leadership, then you take party positions which are opposite and different than the other person, and you have some disagreements at that point. But I think most of the stories I talk about Mike are relating to that power aspect of it. And one of the things that one time we were so involved in a battle on the House floor, and it was over West Publishing, which publishes our revised statutes, you know, the red books. Mm-hmm. I was favoring retention of West Publishing. Madigan was favoring moving to another company. And he couldn't get enough votes to get it done and wouldn't call the roll. And so I walked up to the podium and I said, "Mike, call the blankety blank roll." And so I walked away. He forgot the microphone was on. And he said in the microphone, "That effing Daniels." And it went through. Remember, the speaker's podium goes through all the state offices. Nah. And with that, I get a call on my House floor phone from the governor, who says, "Is this the effing Daniels that was just heard?" You know, and the point I'm making is that was one of those instances where the debate was so strong and so passionate, and so we believe so much into it that, you know, there are times that you really kind of display your emotions in other ways.
One last direct question about Madigan, and then we'll move on away from Madigan. Did he ever share a piece of his apple with you?
I took one. One time I was in his office, he was peeling the apple. I just reached over, took it, and ate it. And I think some of his staff that were in the room there, was a gasp short.
What's the story on that? I don't know the story about the
apple. That's what he eats for lunch, an apple.
Oh.
And he has a paring knife and an apple, and he'll peel the apple, and he'll slice the apple, and then he'll eat it while you're having your discussion.
Oh, that's what I do for breakfast.
It looks good to me, so I just reached over one time and ate it.
That's what I do for breakfast, but I give two slices to my wife before I leave the house.
Aren't you generous?
Interesting.
If he poured you a drink, would you drink it?
Sure.
So what's your take on gerrymandering in Illinois?
Well, if I control it, it's great. So the take is that it's a partisan effort. I remember gerrymandering from the early days because I would sit in George Ryan's office and we had a map, a ruler, and a pencil. And because it's just the advent of computers that were starting to come out into their own. And we would draw a line and then try to match that line to a legal description. And would say, how's this district look for Paul? How's this district look for Bob? You know, and can Bob win that? Well, we think he could win that because that's a neighborhood that he likes. And you'd literally do it on a map. Then today, it's entirely different. Today, it's all by computers. It's all by statistics. You can draw any district anywhere in the United States of America and elect a Republican, a Democrat, or a communist if that's what you want. So I could take a district in the heart of Chicago and draw a district in such a fashion that a Republican could be elected in it if I had complete control of the remap. So it's the sophistication of computers and the advent of modernization has allowed these gerrymandering to take place where it's, I think it's working to the disadvantage of people. So how do you correct that? One of the ways is you take it out of their hands and just draw very stark districts by computers. Now, I could tell you that that would cause some very dramatic impact on areas in the state of Illinois, but you've got to do a better way than it's done now.
It seems to me there's a mathematical way to do it, and you just do it.
Iowa has a commission that they use, and they use a computer to do it. It's probably one of the best ways in the country.
It's all big data. Just got to figure out how to manipulate it or
That's
work
true.
It.
That's
right?
True. Yeah.
What's your favorite memory serving in the House? Just one favorite memory.
Being elected Speaker.
Did you have a big party that night?
Oh, yeah.
The next day?
Do you remember it clearly?
Yes. Remember now, when I was elected Speaker, we hadn't had control of the House for years.
Right.
And so it was George Ryan was the last Republican Speaker before me. And he was the speaker in 81, and I was elected in 95 for speaker. And we haven't had the speakership since 97, so when it happens again, there'll be another big party.
If you were governor and you were governing Illinois right now, what are the top three things you would do?
Well, first of all, you have to balance a budget. You have to bring a budget to the state, and you have to make sure you pay for the necessary items of the state. One of the things I would do is bring the leaders of state government together at all levels, our constitutional officers, our members of the House and Senate, the leadership. In this case today, it's Madigan, Cullerton, Brady, and Jim Durkin. And I would sit down with them and say, what are your needs? What should we do? How do we get to a conclusion here? I don't want to air these problems in public. I don't want to be calling you a bum. I don't want you to call me a bum. I want to work towards a solution. But I need to know what you need as a priority. For instance, one leader may say the priority is schools. Another leader might say the priority is dealing with mental health issues. What are your priorities and how do we get to solving the things that you have? At the same time, pass a capital bill to deal with our infrastructure needs.
So I think I heard you say to fix the financial woes of the state is going to take the right governor. Describe what that governor would look like, and is there a candidate out there right now that you're willing to say you would support?
Well, there's only two running the Republican primary, so instead of going on the record, let's just leave it at, you know, they've got two candidates in the Republican. What do you have, seven on the Democrat side? Some number.
Well, what would you advise the winner of the Republican Party?
I would say, as I said earlier, I would call in the leaders of the state. That means starting with the four leaders in the General Assembly, and I would tell them that we need to move forward in the state, and I'm there to help them. How can we move the ball forward? What do they need? Rich, what do you need on behalf of your caucus? What are the issues that are important to you and your caucus? Schools, parks, infrastructure? Put down some needs that you have. I want to work with you, Rich. And by the way, the discussions we have in these meetings stay in these meetings. I don't go out and hold a press conference and say, oh, yeah, Rich and I met the other day, and all he wants is something for his district. He doesn't care about anyone else. I'm going to treat you with respect if you treat me with respect. And remember why we're here, because no matter what is said, we're only going to be here for a short time. When I talk about being in government for 32 years, I don't know what happened in those 32 years. It went so fast. So my time in government is only a short time in the history of this state, just as anyone else's. So let's make a difference and let's make it work.
Would you consider running for governor?
No.
I was going to say, okay, you have an incredible amount of wisdom, which I could explain by going on and on. But so why wouldn't, I mean, not why wouldn't you, but why wouldn't you? No, I saw Henry Hyde debate Christine Sigalas. And he killed her because of his wisdom.
Right.
You have an incredible amount of governmental wisdom, which would be great for the state.
It's a different system today.
Yeah.
I had what I call my tour of duty, several tours of duty.
Which we appreciate.
Yeah, thank you. Yes.
Thank you for your service. Is that the politically correct thing to say?
Yes, it is.
It's the truth. I mean, think about what he did.
But, you know, the fact of the matter is that I look for a younger person today in government. I look for somebody that carries with them some native intelligence, if I can use that. Somebody that'll listen to people. Somebody that's not in there just for themselves. And you would think when you have people that of wealth running for office, you'd think, well, this will be good because they don't have to have the money or the job. They won't be tempted.
Right.
But the fact of the matter is somebody of wealth has a tendency to be very strong in their approach to government. And it's different than the approach to business. Me as a business owner in my own shop, if I want something done, I call my assistant in. I say, take care of this. Yes, sir. If I go into government and I call Mike Madigan and I say, I want this done, he's not going to say, yes, sir.
Right.
He's going to compromise, negotiate, and that's what it's all about. And it's for the good of people to get things done.
Do you have a protege that you're working with or grooming?
Not at this time.
So I'm interested in your take on DuPage County in particular. Obviously, it was a very strong Republican county for a long, long time.
Right.
And a wonderful place to raise a family, a safe place. The last three presidential elections, the Democratic candidate has actually carried DuPage County. It seems like a lot of folks are moving here because they want to raise their families here. And yet they're bringing politics from where they came from that's not such a great place to raise their family. And why do you think that is? Why do you think that we're not the strong Republican county we once were, although we're still mostly Republican?
Well, you know, you're reading it well, because what has happened is in the past, people would move to DuPage, they would leave their politics behind and adopt the politics here. But we had strong organizations here. We worked precincts, we passed our message, we passed out signs, we met with people, and the organization and our committeemen were strong in their nature. Today, it's not as strong. Not to say it's not existent, it is. But, you know, Addison Township, for instance, under Pat Durante, is legendary in this state.
Yeah.
You know, you couldn't win DuPage without having Addison Township on your side. So today, and I was with my wife the other day, and we were at a restaurant, and we were watching people flock into the restaurant with kids. And you know, we were smiling and laughing. He said, look at this town. This town of Elmhurst is now overridden with children, which is wonderful because of it's such a great future for what we have here.
Right.
But people today are bringing their politics with them. They're not leaving it behind. Now, is that good or bad? It's not bad. And it's good in the sense that they are involved people. But we, as people that served in government or serve in government today, have a responsibility to make sure we get our message out. What's this government all about? We can't sit back and say, you'll just understand it.
No, we have to show people what it's about. We have to get the message out. We have to go door to door. And at election time, we have to make sure that people understand what we stand for and why we stand for it. Why do we stand for safety? Why do we have safe schools here? Why do we have a law enforcement community that's second to none? Why do we have a beautiful town that's on the upsurge where so many towns in this country are not? It's because of the leadership and the quality of people that represent us. You know, I'm a fan of Steve Morley's. I think he's doing a wonderful job for our city. But look what he has, a council that he works with and gets things done. Just the other day, I heard him speak, and he said, in one block in Elmhurst on Addison Street between 1st and 2nd is $70 million in infrastructure improvement going on in that area. This is our town, and that's why people are coming here.
It's a great town. And on that note, we'll take another quick break, and we'll be back in a minute with our last segment.
My fellow Elmhurstians, ask not what Elmhurst can do for you. Ask what you can do for Elmhurst. And you can start by listening to Robbie and Rick on the E-Town Lowdown.
Hi, Scott Lamort here, drum major of the world-famous Elmhurst Armpit Orchestra, and you are listening to the E-Town Lowdown with your hosts, Robbie and Rick.
And we're back on the Lowdown with our special guest, Lee Daniels.
So, Lee, we know you have a building name for you at Elmhurst College. Tell us about your connection with Elmhurst College.
Started when I was young. I took my confirmation classes there.
You know, really?
Yeah. And so when I was in eighth grade in Old Main, which is the main headquarter, national landmark, Old Main. And as a kid, I used to go over to the mall and play pickup football with my friends until we were kicked out. But as I said earlier, I grew up on Cottage Hill. So we were very close to the college and walk around and see. My dad would hire people from the college to help my mom with the house. And so we frequently saw college kids. When I became a member of the General Assembly, there were times where I could do some infrastructure work and help the college, and was always happy to do that, you know, from remodeling some of the buildings to some of the other infrastructure work. So over the years did that. And then because of my relationship with the college, they gave me an award in 1988, an award for public service, and then later on a few other awards, and then when I was elected speaker and was able to help the college a little bit more, and I was honored to receive an honorary doctorate of laws in 1996.
Dr. Daniels.
My wife said I could do that for a day.
Oh, all right. Well, I'm going to do it for the rest of our lives now that I know that.
She even called me Dr. Daniels for a day and had a plaque made out that says Dr. Daniels on it. So
nice.
That was a great honor and a great day, too. Joe Herter kind of was... as a long-term member of the board, was helped me out with some of the things of the college. And then I was, after I left government, I was pleased to have the college name the Computer Science Building after me. So right. It was quite an honor.
Yeah. But you actually work for them, too.
Yes, I taught for 3 years in the political science department.
Nice.
Share the title of Distinguished Fellow. So it was really quite interesting. In fact,
did you teach a class?
Yeah, for 3 years.
I wish I would have taken it.
Yeah, I don't know. one year the class was actually in Daniels Hall. And the end of the semester, one of the students came up to me, "Do you know this guy Daniels? Who's this plate named after?" I said, "Yeah, I've met him before." He's an older guy.
Okay, so that guy didn't get an A.
Yeah, no, he didn't.
And what are you doing now for the college?
Now I'm senior advisor to the president, so I serve at the pleasure of the president. And some of the charges I have are dealing with legislative issues, some of the other issues that involve the college, maybe governmentally, the city, as you know, because you were chairman of what we call the Town and Gown Commission.
Which you basically had the charge of getting that off the ground from the mayor and the president of the college at the time.
Right. And you served as a great chairman. Still a member of that board you are.
Right.
So that was another thing. But I also run the President's Breakfast every year, as well as a governmental forum. And this year, our governmental forum is April 18th at Oakbrook Hills Resort.
Anybody we've ever heard of speaking there this year?
Governor Jeb Bush is our speaker, so we're quite excited about that.
Nice. So wait, you're the senior advisor to the president.
Right.
Do they need a junior advisor to the president? Because I got a little free time.
The president can always use competent advisors.
So as long as we're on what you're doing now, You also have a firm. I don't know if it's a real estate firm, a law firm. Tell us a little bit about what else you do.
Well, I retired from my law firm when I left government in 2007. And when you retire, one of the things you do if you want to get some of your pension benefits is you can't practice law. So for 6 years, I was restricted from practicing the law as competition to the firm. I thought that was a little antiquated, but that's the way it was.
Boy, excuse me for a second. You can't practice when you retire, but you can practice while you're serving.
That's true.
That's kind of interesting, isn't it?
Well, but I retired from the law firm.
Yeah.
So in order to get your pension payout benefits,
so you're not competing with a law firm.
Not competing with them. And of course, it was a good deal, so I didn't want to compete.
Yeah.
So I had to do something else in the interim, so I founded a company which deals with government and community relations. So I do any number of things, whether it's real estate or consulting work or, for instance, to the senior advisor to the president, things of that nature.
You also serve on a few boards.
I do.
In the community. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. I serve on two real estate investment trust boards. One is Inland Real Estate Investment Trust out of Oak Brook, and our net assets are about $1.4 billion. And I serve.
Wait, that's a lot of zeros.
That's a lot of zeros.
$1.4 billion.
I am awestruck by the number of zeros. And then I serve on a board called Kite Realty out of Indianapolis, Indiana. Hmm. That's a real estate investment trust board that's publicly registered and publicly traded. And our net assets are over $4 billion on that one.
Wow.
I serve as the chairman of the board of the Haymarket Center out of Chicago. That's a non-for-profit drug and alcohol treatment center. We treat 14,000 people a year out of that center.
Wow.
And it's very involved in the crisis that we're facing now and the epidemic and drug overdoses.
Yeah, right. That's huge. How'd you get involved in that?
After I left government, a friend of mine, Tom Roser, who is fairly known in the government world, encouraged me to join the board. For a long time, I said no, but then I finally joined the board and was on the board. And the then chairman passed away. And prior to passing away, he asked that I be made the chairman of the board. So I became chairman 4 years ago.
Do you have a position on marijuana and whether or not it should be legalized?
I do. You know, where I understand the movement today is pretty liberal as far as marijuana, and I support smaller enforcement laws on the use of marijuana because I don't think it's a violent crime. However, there's very little question that marijuana can lead to other drug usage. Being involved in a drug and treatment center, we see this. A lot of people that become heroin addicts started with marijuana first. The problem with marijuana legalization is there's not enough scientific data to show what it does to the human brain and the interaction.
Didn't a lot of them eat Dunkin' Donuts as kids too, though? I mean, sure. how do you say one is necessarily linked to the other?
Well, the difference is that when you eat a donut, you're not intentionally overdosing, or you're not intentionally becoming inebriated.
Actually, I know people that overdose on donuts, but that's a different story.
No, I guess where I'm going with that though is they're both illegal. Marijuana is illegal, and the harder drugs are illegal.
Right?
Don't you think there's certain personality types that just, you know, if they're going to try one illegal thing, they'll try another. It doesn't necessarily lead from one to the other.
Trying to put it in a nutshell, here's the problem: you don't have enough scientific evidence to tell you what actually is occurring with the use of marijuana. There hasn't been scientific studies on the use of it and what you can. You can't say that Bob or Paul, in one case, if they smoke a joint, they'll be fine. And if you and I smoke a joint, we won't be. There's not enough evidence on that to show that. We need more scientific studies of that, which would support the legalization. And if so, when you and people say, well, alcohol is legal. Yes, it is to an extent. It's not legal to get drunk and to drive drunk or even walk drunk for that matter.
Right.
And people, when they have alcohol, you and I might have a drink. We're not intentionally setting out to get drunk. But when you smoke a joint, you're intentionally setting out to get high. And there's a difference there. So don't use this as an excuse to raise money. Use it what's in the public interest. And what we need to do is put more money in scientific studies of it before we go that route.
Let's change gears a bit and ask you about your family.
Sure.
Your wife, your kids, what are your kids up to?
Are they in the area?
Hopefully they're good. I have five children, yeah. Right? My eldest daughter, Lori, suffered brain damage shortly after birth. She's both physically and mentally challenged. She lives in what's called a CILA, community integrated living arrangement in Orland Park, and that's a regular home. You drive down the street, it's in a neighborhood, but it has 24-hour staffing, and she lives with three other adult women. And she works 5 days a week, and she's doing fabulous. We're very proud of Lori. My next child is Rachel. Rachel is a teacher in Orlando, Florida. And her husband's with the Orlando Utility Commission, and they have three kids. My oldest granddaughter is graduating from Clemson in May. Yes. And then my second oldest granddaughter is a senior in high school and will go to college next year. And then my third granddaughter from Florida is going to be a junior in high school. Then I have my next daughter is Julia. Julia lives here in Elmhurst with her two boys, Armando and Maximo, and they go to field school. And Julia is a physician assistant, and she's a professor at Dominican University in River Forest. She teaches health sciences. She's a physician assistant in their College of Physician Assistants.
Nice.
And then my next child is Tom, and Tom is a lawyer. And he's the North American General Counsel for Global Management System. They make the innards of cash stations and slot machines, which spit out the money. I say, is there any way you can show me?
It's an important function.
Can you show me how you do that? And then my...
Just install one in your basement. That would be great.
Right.
Yeah.
And then my fifth child is Christina, and she is married and lives with her husband in Chicago, and they run a business called Mr. Dave Music. It caters to young children in music shows and programs and raves. I forgot to mention Tom's wife, Amy. Amy is a mortgage broker, and they have three children. And so we have eight grandchildren altogether.
As you know, I got to know Christina a little bit through the City and College Commission, and she's absolutely delightful and a very intelligent lady that really brought a lot to the table when she was on the commission.
And is that so? That's four daughters and one son. Did I catch that?
That's
right?
Correct. Yeah. Four daughters and one son.
And behind every great man is a wonderful woman, Pam.
That's true. Pam, my wife, is beyond wonderful. She's understanding, compassionate, and she's raised our kids, and we're all proud of our kids. And I think if any star you'd have, it's how your children turn out. We're very fortunate that our children are really great citizens.
I always say my wife did 90% of the work.
Well, Pam probably go far. 99% of the work, yeah. But Pam is, as you might expect, taking care of grandchildren now.
Nice. Did you have any advice for your kids in terms of getting into politics or staying away from politics?
No, I didn't, because they saw it firsthand, and none of them have gone into it. What I did tell them is, I'm not going to tell you how to vote. I just expect you to vote.
Do you have any pets?
Well, we have a cat. Bosworth is his name, but it's Mr. Bosworth, if you will. We had a dog named Molly, and Molly passed away. So we're talking about getting another dog, but I love dogs and I love cats. So, yeah.
Where does the name Bosworth come from, Mr. Bosworth?
Well, my son-in-law actually found this cat in a shelter and brought it to my wife because she expressed a interest in cats. And I grew up with cats as a kid, as you might expect, with all my family members. And we asked him what the name was, and he said Bosworth. So they named the cat Bosworth. But I quickly learned that this cat really insisted on being referred to with respect. So I call him Mr. Bosworth.
Just like your Dr. Daniels.
That's right.
Do you have any hobbies?
You know, I used to do a lot of running in the early days, but my knees started giving us, so now I try to walk, and I like exercise, but I like biking. I've gotten away from a guy by the name of Kevin York is trying to get me interested in biking.
Oh, we know him.
You know him?
Yeah. Bike shorts.
Yeah. Tight bike shorts. He's right. Kind of got that. He's got a sweatshirt on and bike shorts. Not sure why.
And I got to get back in golf, so that's another thing I like.
Do you have a favorite vacation spot now as an adult?
Now, it would have to be my home in Michigan, New Buffalo, Michigan, which we're fortunate to be on the lake, and it's really a great place to be.
Have you been invited, PK?
Haven't.
How about you, Robbie?
Haven't seen that.
Not yet.
Oh, okay.
I was waiting until the show is over to see how you guys treat me before I invite you up there.
It is a great place, though. I remember going up there as a kid. Yeah.
So you were inducted into the Elmhurst Civic Hall of Fame, which is just one of the many honors you've had. How'd you feel about that?
Well, I was honored. I mean, it's my hometown. I've lived here all my life, except for the first 6 months I explained earlier, and which I had no part in.
We forgive you for that.
Thank you. Yeah. And, you know, I believe strongly in the city. I love what's happening right now in terms of the development of our city, improving our tax base and dealing with jobs and creation. And it's a fun place to be.
It really is. Yeah. What accomplishments, personal or professional, are you most proud of?
Becoming a lawyer, being elected to the House, and being elected Speaker of the House.
What do you want to do when you retire?
I want to stay involved in probably nonprofit work. Learned a lot through the Haymarket Center and people's needs. And I think at the end of the day, if you're fortunate enough to be able to serve people, that's really a great honor.
I got one for you, Lee. So you wake up and you find yourself in jail with a bunch of gnarly bikers in Sturgis, South Dakota. Who do you call?
I call you.
You're right, because I would be there.
And you have a car.
Well,
he has a bike.
I have a bike, and I've been there twice, but yeah. I'm the guy to call. I know my way around Sturgis.
I'll probably call Joe Herter. Over the years, Joe Herter's been my greatest advisor. He's been my tax accountant. He's been my closest personal friend.
He's an all-around great guy, a friend of mine also.
And he'd know what to do.
He would. Well, Lee, this was delightful. Thank you so much for taking your time to be with us. We look forward to having you on again, and I hope you'll listen to some of our other shows, too.
I will.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you for your service.
Thank you, Lee.
Thank you. Thank you, man.
Thanks, Lee.
The E-Town Lowdown encourages you to like Explore Elmhurst on Facebook, a great resource so you, too, can be in the know when it comes to Elmhurst. Elmhurst, close to everything, unlike anything.